You know that nuclear deal with Iran that took more than a decade to reach? Not easy to get there, but now the hard work really starts. President Obama has to sell it to Congress, where he'll hear from plenty of outspoken critics. But U.S. lawmakers aren't the only skeptics. In a few minutes, we'll hear from one Israeli calls the deal a farce. Before that, though, let's take a closer look at how the deal actually happened. In fact, if not for two MIT-trained nuclear scientists, we might not have any deal at all. Current U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz was one of those scientists brought into the talks. His Iranian counterpart was the other. Moniz told me that, simply put, the diplomats got to the point in the negotiations where they needed some nuclear scientists.
To reach an agreement, there were a whole set of issues with considerable technical dimension that had to be resolved. And so I think that Dr. Salehi and I, joining the talks as head of, roughly speaking, of the major nuclear organizations in the two governments, were able to move forward, resolve some of the technical issues, and that then I think helped the foreign ministers, if you like, including John Kerry, to move forward on other issues that, of course, were equally important.
Right, Dr. Salehi, Ali Akbar Salehi, your Iranian counterpart. Did you trust your counterparts at the talks?
Well, first of all, we did share, as you probably know, a background at MIT. We didn't know each other, but it did help to establish a relationship. We were able to, get quickly into what I would call the MIT problem-solving approach. And so we were able to march through quite a few issues, and to do so with a lot of specificity that I think will position the next 90 days of talks quite well.
Right. So now you're back in Washington. When you try to sell the idea of the Iran deal to legislators on Capitol Hill, what's your kind of elevator pitch, especially for those lawmakers who really can't get past the politics?
Well, first of all, I think at a very high level, it's very important to understand that the parameters that we established for the agreement are not based upon trust. That's not where we're starting from. It's based upon verification. And so an enormous part of the agreement are rather exceptional measures that will enhance access and transparency. So that's number one. Number two, that we had to address all of the potential pathways to a nuclear weapon. That includes uranium pathways through enrichment. It includes plutonium pathways through the research reactor that they are planning to build. It also includes the covert pathways, which of course circles right back to the issues of access and transparency, not only to declared nuclear sites, but also to other sites that might be suspect and require access.
You've called this the forever accord, but there are stipulations in the deal for certain parts of it to expire in 10 years, some in 15, some in 20. Why do you see this as almost permanent?
Well, no. What I said is it's forever in the sense that there are some provisions that go on forever. No reprocessing of nuclear reactor fuel forever, for example. Shipping out fuel from that reactor for the entire lifetime of the reactor. And the intent is that Iran will have, again, the opportunity to convince everyone over time that they, in fact, have strictly peaceful purposes in mind in their nuclear program.
So a lot of false departures from the Hotel Beau Rivage in the last days of the negotiations there in Lausanne, some political theater perhaps. I'm curious, how many times did you have to pack and repack your bags at the hotel?
Oh, it was a few times. But
did you lose count?
I would say it's probably two or three. But look, there were some very, very tough issues. There's no question around it. And, you know, I think it was very professional, as I said. And that doesn't mean it wasn't very tense at certain times. And sometimes the light at the end of the tunnel was thought to be an oncoming train. And other times it was viewed to be the exit to a solution. Fortunately, in the last couple of days, we were able to converge to what I think is certainly a very good deal for us in terms of our key objectives. But also, it's a good deal for Iran in the sense that it gets this opportunity to develop nuclear power, assuming that the terms of the agreement, which still has to be finalized in 90 days, assuming those terms are in fact followed.
U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz there. As you've no doubt heard, not everyone shares his enthusiasm about the Iran deal. The world's Aaron Schachter has more.
Marco, how about this for not sharing the secretary's enthusiasm?
It's as though mighty Iran, you know, has to be appeased by a trembling, pusillanimous West.
David Horovitz is the founding editor of The Times of Israel. He calls the nuclear deal a farce, one that doesn't get the West what it really wanted.
I think the concern for people who take Iran seriously as a ruthless, threatening, rapacious regime is that the whole fundamental of the approach is wrong. Instead of dismantling Iran's nuclear facilities, the fundamental approach shifted to freezing and inspecting.
I agree with David that the Iranian regime has been one of the most vicious in terms of the language that it has used against the state of Israel and how much it hates Israel. But at the same time, we have to look at the realities here.
Perhaps the most real reality, according to Israeli-Iranian analyst Meir Javadanfar, is that Iran was never going to dismantle its nuclear program. Another reality, he says, Iran may be nasty, but it's not stupid.
The Iranian regime takes Israel's military capability very seriously. And at the same time, the Iranian regime takes its own survival even more seriously. And the scenario that the Iranian regime would go through all this just to get another round of sanctions imposed against it and to enter into another round of confrontation by making a nuclear weapon doesn't make much sense to me.
Horovitz doesn't buy that. If Iran really wanted to play along with the rest of the world, he says, it could have saved everyone a whole lot of time and trouble.
This is a nefarious regime that was dragged to the negotiating table because of a painstakingly assembled hierarchy of economic pressures. And yet, the Iranians have been allowed off the ropes, off the floor, and now the world powers complain, well, we couldn't have done better. But of course they could have done better.
Yes, the U.S. and its allies might have done better, and they might not have. It's a negotiation, after all. But Suzanne Maloney with the Brookings Institution says it's exactly that painstakingly assembled hierarchy that made a better deal next to impossible.
For most of the past 36 years, the United States has pretty much gone it alone when it comes to pressuring Iran, whether it's on the nuclear issue or other concerns about weapons of mass destruction or other aspects of Iran's foreign and domestic policies, which are intensely problematic. The rest of the world simply has not been willing to apply pressure to Iran in order to try to effect some sort of a change in those policies. That has all changed.
The change has come, she says, because U.S. allies were nervous about Iran's rhetoric, Iran's treatment of its citizens after elections in 2009, and yes, world opinion changed because of the fear of an Iran with nuclear weapons. And that change in opinion led to worldwide sanctions. So if some sanctions worked, why not more? Maloney says that sounds nice in theory.
But in reality, we wouldn't find the same level of international adherence to the sanctions. We wouldn't find the coalition willing to hang together.
And if the coalition does fall apart, she says, so too does any chance of the world honoring additional U.S. sanctions. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.